poisonous roses. The wild boys. I am not a witch. The long excuse. Blew my mind. Custody. Unicornio. Vinto Brodre. And have a nice day. Which of those will be the podcast's film of 2018? Let's find out as I welcome you all to the final ever episode of the Outside Centre Film Podcast, at least for a while. What does that mean? Well, I'll be back in touch soon about what happens next as we undergo yet another costume change, but don't worry, it's all good news. But for now, we've got a lot to get through, and it has been, and as it has been all year, it's the film director extraordinaire, Mr. Ben Woodywis, who likes to make a British film or two that isn't strictly so British and wants to make you pull your hair out, and Sarah Cook from Picture House Central in London that actually give a toss about real cinema as well. Both of those will be talking films with me. Guys, before we hit the present awards from our 9 list of Film of the Weeks that we've compiled together throughout the year, let's look to the future. Let's look for a couple of weeks or about a month or so, where we'll be all be watching and discussing the Oscars 2019. And as was predicted last time out, one prediction we did get right is that by the time we'd meet for this episode, all of the semi-final candidates for the foreign language Oscar will be announced, and they have done that. And well, it's what I think one of the things we all said was that the tends, and it is true when we say that the Oscar ceremony tends to ignore Asian cinema. We've got plenty here, at least at this stage. The full 9 semi-final films are. Birds of Passage from Colombia. We've got The Guilty from Denmark, which I think we all said would probably make it on there. Never Look Away from Germany. We've got Shoplifters from Japan, which I know, Sarah, you were big on, and it's probably because of Koreeda's career so far. It's not a surprise he's made it this far either. A big surprise would be the Kazakhstan film Aika, I guess. Hasn't rung any sort of bell with me at all. Capernaum from Lebanon. That did well at Cannes, so I guess. And Lebanon's got a little bit of recent history with the thing, so I suppose that's not a big surprise either. Neither would be Roma from Alfonso Cuarón, which I think we talked about last time as well. Cold War as well. We've got some Oscar history there with the director of Cold War. But a South Korean film's made it to the semi-final, it's Burning. Can't remember the last time that's happened. So, Ben, start with you. Just a quick gander at this semi-final list. What are your thoughts of it? I mean, a lot of it is predictable, but there are a couple of surprises there.
There really are. I think that for me, the big question is what's going to join Roma, Cold War, and Shoplifters?
Yeah,
in the final five. Like that. So two of you guys are coming in with us, and who's it going to be? It's a tough call from what's left over. Yeah. The only one seen of the leftover films is The Guilty. So I'm leaning towards The Guilty, the one I saw. Also, it's getting an American remake as well.
Wow, that's set in stone then. That always bloody happens. Yeah. And also, to be fair, Denmark does have, I think it's 2 years in a row it's made the final list.
Yeah.
And they've had a good history in it, so that's normally a safe bet.
And it's a socially relevant film.
It is.
To go out as well. It's one of those films that looks at both sides of things really, really equally. And I don't know, just be tidy, really. I don't know. I saw the trailer for Never Look Away the other day, but ironically, I didn't watch most of it.
Oh dear, so you looked away, right?
Yeah. So I'm not sure how it's going to. So I don't know. Anyone's game, but it's definitely those three: Roma, Cold War, and Shoplifters. And then two of you other guys can come in.
I think you can't compete with Alfonso Cuarón as a name. Anyway,
no.
So I think he's got the monopoly here, but I do disagree. I think The Guilty will be edged out. I think The Burning will get on there purely because of Steven Yeun.
Oh, okay.
And I think Capernaum will get in there because Capernaum is being one of the few films that's been just 5-star reviews across the board. And it's been a quite festival darling, and also it's a Picture House release, so I feel like if I don't mention that Capernaum is going to be in the Oscar finale, I think I wouldn't have a job by the time I get back from the holidays. So I think Capernaum will edge out The Guilty. I definitely think Burning will get in. I think because they've got an American Asian star in it,
yes,
and because it has been well received, I think Burning will get an edge in there, because that's the kind of ones that people know.
Yes, of course.
But Capernaum, I think, will edge out The Guilty. I think the rest of them, I don't think. I think we're those three: Roma, Cold War, and Shoplifters. Will definitely, they're the three that will definitely get in there. But Capernaum and Burning.
The most predictable winner out of this list is, without question, Roma, and it will win. it will win. It just, there's been ones in the past where you've just known it was going to happen. Last year, it was a terrible movie. The Iranian film The Salesman was a terrible movie. But because it was based on an American playwright who they love over there, of course it was going to win. What else are you going to do when you're Hollywood? So, this time around, this is more interesting.
Sorry.
Yeah, it will be very interesting.
Because it's a Netflix movie in particular, and so if Roma, then Netflix walk away with an Oscar, basically, and Netflix are going to be reminding everyone about how they got booed out of Cannes. I think they made Roma specifically just to snub the entire world about them getting booed out of Cannes.
Indeed. possibly. We all do Netflix now. Even I do, and that's saying something. So that's an interesting list. I can't help but feel that some of these are choking for tokenism, just to prove that, we do care in world cinema. You can guarantee Birds of Passage from Colombia won't make it through. I mean, that's just a guarantee. Not going to happen. Will the Kazakhstani film make it? Probably not. But again, they're showing interest in the world, it's frightfully predictable. And who gives a shit, basically? I mean, it is like that. Because, we will all, me on the YouTube channel, you got Picture House, and Ben, you're in your own personal time for enjoyment and inspiration. You'll all be choosing to watch foreign language films throughout the year. That won't be any of these, probably. And you'll just be kind of picking your own things from your own different... this is the clearest win for a film that I think in the Oscars since Sorrentino won for The Great Beauty, probably. I mean, The Great Beauty was a truly piece of shit movie, apart from the first 10 minutes. But in that list it was amongst, even though there were better films in it, you just had this horrible feeling that The Great Beauty was going to win it that year, and it did. This is the list that really matters. Me, Ben, Sarah, and... I think first up, we've got Poisonous Roses, which I'm not going to bore you about too much because we talked about it last time out. But for time's sake, it's a slice of everyday blue-collar life in modern Egypt. We follow Tahia, who lives with her brother and becomes increasingly jealous of him and the new relationship he has with a new girlfriend. And she starts to follow him around. So I think, guys, in summary, we'll call this film Tanning Hatem, Brother Chasem. We won't spend too long on this one, as I say, because we've already discussed it very recently. What is it about this film that made it onto this list? Kind of the last possible chance of doing so. For me, as I said before, it was the soundtrack to the movie. It was the tanning pits, it was the glue factory. I like the characters in this movie. There are some moments between female friends where they kind of talk about the oppressive nature of the society around them, which we'd expect from like the North African thing. That's heavily based on religion. We see lots of examples of the way of life in this part of the world. We see people sitting around with an awful lot of nothing, but being happily contented. We see some sort of cleric figure that believes in the old African kind of witchcraft thing. Odd bits of furniture lying around, questionable hygiene. As I say, the living and working conditions, really interesting cinematically. And despite the restrictive nature of all these people's lives, we've got director Fozzie Saleh, who has made a very cinematic film here. I love the shot in particular when you kind of see the workers climbing in between the two pallets of glue. And the overhead shot to begin with of like a poisonous river of ink and tanning stuff and that kind of thing. So cinematic, interesting. I think initially I had this at like a 7 out of 10. And then we kind of talked about it some more and actually realised... the more you talk about it and the more you really break this film down, the more you end up loving it. So it's not in my top three of the year, but to be honest, it does kind of stick out as relatively unique even in this list. So for me, Sarah, it absolutely deserves its place on the final year list.
Yeah, I agree. I agree with everything you just said. It's one of those films that I think I said last time, you can smell everything that's on the screen. It's so well done. You can smell like the tanning places and everything. And I love that kind of relationship she has with her brother. And that, I just think it's a really, really well done film.
I mean, we'll see. I mean, it's got practically, Ben, it's got practically no cinema release. It won't get one because it's already out of date. But this is to be recommended for anybody, I would guess. It's a quality film.
It is, absolutely. I mean, I can't remember if I mentioned this last time, but I've put this forward to be a film picked up by the organization I work for to show this film to older teenagers. It's a fantastic slice of life. in Cairo. It's also just a fantastic window into another world that young people experience. For me, I can't remember if I wanged on about this before, but one of my favorite things about films is the way they explore either time or space, or both, preferably. And Poisonous Roses does this really well. It explores time and spaces extremely well, moving you through these kind of like fantastic places. One of the problems I have with a lot of CGI action movies is that everything is phony, all the spaces are phony. But I love the fact that in Poisonous Roses, you're going through these real places, experiencing them in this first person perspective. It's a very rich film. It's also very simple as well. It's beguilingly simple. And it might leave some people thinking, well, you know, that was a lot of stuff about nothing, which is, you know, you could say, but at the same time, there's a lot of gold nuggets in here. Not in my top three, but I did really enjoy watching this.
I mean, it could be a lot about nothing, could apply to an awful lot of these movies, including ones that we all like. So
it's very difficult to pinpoint why one thing stands above others. It's hard to get at this. It's personal responses, I guess. I could hear, you know, again, your racist uncle sat at the back of the cinema and go, what was all that about? At the Poisonous Roses. You could say that about any of the films we watched.
And definitely a lot more than that for some of them as well, for sure. it's interesting because, I mean, I'm sure we'll probably have a brief discussion about, you know, divisiveness. And if something can be divisive and accepted, what is divisiveness exactly? Is it a good thing? Is it a bad thing? Is it good that three people would like it and three people would hate it? I mean, that's a debate in itself. Can you really please anybody, everybody at the same time? It's practically impossible. I mean,
you get people who tap into it without knowing it, like Spielberg. Spielberg makes films that he wanted to make, and everyone's on board straight away. And that's a very rare quality, I think.
Absolutely. I mean, this is I would probably say, out of all the films on this list, this is the least offensive to people. We have got some subjects coming up that are just ridiculous. We've got. I mean, we'll get into all of them. I mean, and the next one in particular is ridiculous. But, divisiveness reigns supreme. A good solid film. And for the sake of ordinariness is fine for movies. And this, again, I would say it's the least divisive and it's the most ordinary out of all of these films. With exception probably to the Japanese one we'll come on later to. Poisonous Roses did well to get in, did very well. And if anybody has a chance to watch Poisonous Roses, do so. Ben.
Hello.
Now, before we move on to the next movie, I'm just going to point something out. It's a little bit of an elephant in the room, basically. So out of these nine films, four of them were films that I myself put forward to be watched with the group. Mm-hmm. Right? Four of them. Mm-hmm. Four of them were films that Sarah put forward to watch for the rest of the group.
Huh.
One of them is yours. It's that you are the only person to like that movie. So I just want to ask you, how do you think it's gone this year for you, Ben? How do you think it's gone?
I think it's gone pretty great. It's not a game about scoring points. We're not scoring points here.
Unfortunately, we literally are scoring.
Okay, I'll tell you that. I think it's gone fine. My approach to selecting films has been very much what one might call blind, which is part and parcel of why The Wild Boys by Bertrand Mandico rocked my world so much.
It did indeed. So for anybody, okay, I mean, what we will say is, for all of these, and I should have said it at the beginning, but you know, we didn't really spoil anything in the last one anyway. We've had all year to watch these, with the exception of Poisonous Roses, which is very recent, but still you had a month. So yeah, we expect spoilers because it will help as we kind of try to dissect some of these movies.
Don't spoil The Wild Boys for me. I love that spoiler.
And the spoil that was in the trail, for sure.
What the hell? What are they thinking?
So anyway, just in case it's brand new to anybody, what is The Wild Boys and what happens in it, please, Ben?
So, The Wild Boys, and I'm going to tell this story again because I love this. I put The Wild Boys on, I press play, move to my sofa. In my head, I'm thinking, how is it possible that you can make a film called The Wild Boys and not reference William Burroughs? I'm outraged. Sat down, 5 seconds in, I'm wrong. about this, because The Wild Boys is just wonderful. So what we follow is the adventures of five boys who commit a terrible act against a teacher of theirs, and they then get taken, they get put in the custody of a ship's captain who takes them on a trip on his boat to beat out the kind of evil side of them and turn them into real men. They go to an island where they meet Lena Lohansson as Severin, and hilarity ensues. The Wild Boys is a really special film. I felt like I had to include it in here because I have not seen anything like this for a very long time.
Neither have I.
Right? Well, okay. Again, it did, and this is no joke of a lie. It took me back to my childhood, watching stuff on Channel 4 late at night. What the hell is this? It had all that kind of quality. It is very, very much not the kind of film that I would normally like. It's heavy in the artifice. It's a Guy Maddin film, basically. If no one's if anyone's seen Guy Maddin films, Guy Maddin, written by William Burroughs, no joke. It does all the Burroughs stuff that no one's ever filmed ever before. And then there's an enormous spoiler to be had, which you will see if you see the trailer or read a review or casually talk to someone who's seen this before. But you know what? One of the lead performers, Anil Snook, in this film, has said that at screenings, people don't know. People just don't know. And they get blown away by it. So right. I want to keep this secret going.
Indeed.
I know. It's much more fun if we all talk about the spoiler.
I mean, what you're going to get is, because we did mention the spoil in the episode itself, but when I clean house, as I always do at the end of each year, and get rid of all the episodic episodes where we just have the films in them individually, we talked about it then. So we might catch the odd person who catches me on YouTube, thinks, what on earth was that podcast all about? It sounded shite. Go onto the podcast, listen to the episode where we just talk about it right now, and have no idea about what the twist was because the episode has been deleted. So... Shall we keep that going just for this particular film then?
I got so much out of this film. It reached the point where something happens. I don't want to say what. And I was absolutely giddy. I was so excited. I haven't seen anything like that for so long. There are so many things that I would like to talk about by spoiling it, but I'm not going to talk about, which I found fascinating. My response to the film did a 180. It completely changed with this revelation.
And it made your top three, didn't it?
And it made my top three. But without that.
How about that? Well, I mean, the thing is, what I like about this film, Ben, and I do like something about this film, is the fact you've spent more time on the podcast this year talking about things in this film, such as literary references. I think even on the last episode, or even on Twitter, you mentioned a song that you heard made it.
Yeah, not
in
the last episode, but I should mention that here. They use a piece of music from a giallo movie called The Strange Vice of Mrs. Ward.
Yep.
And I think that really helped me to warm to this film, because like it's like when you watch a bank or car ads and they're using songs from your childhood and you're like, oh, I love this bank, I love this car, so cozy. And this movie kind of locked itself into my cozy spot by using a really great piece of music from Strange Vice of Mrs. Ward. I'm such a giallo fan that I'm drinking J&B's whiskey right now. Huge sponsors of all giallo movies. I got a bottle right here. I really think that kind of like that just put it straight through my subconscious. It wasn't until later after the film that I was like, wait a minute, I've heard that piece of music before, and looked it up. Sorry to interrupt.
No, because that's exactly the point. You've raved about the literature reference, you've raved about the song reference, but what about the film? The film.
When
I hand over to Sarah, because she's not a fan of it either.
She's not a fan.
And this is not a film to be enjoyed by the vast majority of people. Even you'd admit that, Ben. You know, even the specialised folk that have been loyal to us for the last 5 years, you know, it's not the worst film in this list for me. It isn't. No. You know, at least every year on this film, on this list, inevitably you've got different people, different tastes, approaching things from different angles. You're going to have at least one fuck-off film every single year. Yeah. This is not that film, believe it or not, because at least this film has some art behind it. So it's not a complete waste of time, unlike one coming up quite soon. But
This film does have an awful lot of cock in, though. Just to, if everyone wants some kind of... they're not telling me what the film's about. It's got a lot of cock in it. It's got a ship's captain. A lot of fruit eating as well.
Yeah.
And Alina Lowenson. What does anyone need to know?
I mean, one would think at this point, having raved over a film, you'd talk about the narrative or a bit of dramatic tension. No. It's about one particular performer, one literary reference, one song. Sarah, finishes off on the Wild Boys, please. Finishes off.
This is my fuck off film of the week. That's it. That's all you need to know. Like, the only interesting thing is the thing we can't talk about in this film.
I one of the things that it makes me feel like is, you know, Citizen Kane near the beginning where he dies, Rosebud, and he's got that snow globe. The whole film seems to be taking place in a snow globe. It's kind of like isolated, hermetically sealed kind of environment. That again, the antithesis of films I like. I don't like films like that. They suck balls. This one, it worked somehow.
Would you like it as much if you had the sound off?
Part of me would. Yeah, for sure. Would I like it as much without the twist? No. I can say that quite affirmatively. No.
I think people should watch the trail, and you've seen the entire film.
Yeah. I tell you what, on my Twitter page, my Twitter page, like I'm that important, on my Twitter feed, I'll put the safe trailer that people can. If anyone listens to that, go find me at Ben Woodywist, capital B, capital W. Find me on Twitter, I'll have it there. Just have a watch of that one. It's the safe trailer, the one that has no spoilers.
Yeah, I mean, fine. People are welcome. But honestly, I think we've been a bit silly, really, because I think most people know. I think people know what this is. By now, it's been out. Yeah, I think. Anyway, but if not, then go ahead and do that. Sarah, I am not a witch.
Yes, I love this film. But now I'm quite uneasy that you said you haven't picked your fuck off film, so.
You should always be uneasy in my company. You should always be.
Always be uneasy.
Who knows when that big fuck off film will be forthcoming?
Terrifying. I Am Not a Witch, which won the BAFTA Award for Outstanding Debut by a British Writer, is a film by Rugano Nioni and revolves around a little girl who is accused of being a witch, and therefore she's ostracized from the community and sent to live with other women accused of being a witch and brought out at ceremonies to solve crimes. And it is, I adore this film. I think it has a really, really good lead young actress who's called Maggie Maloubwa as Shula. And it had this wonderful, striking, beautiful imagery in Africa. And managed to poke holes at everything it possibly can, including the culture of people believing witches, including white tourists, and bumbling policemen. It has this really great Monty Python-esque opening sequence, which reminded me of the bit in Holy Grail of I'm Not a Newt. She turned me into a newt with this guy trying to say that she killed a chicken or she killed someone, and then it turns out it's just a dream. And I just, I love that kind of balance of different elements in this film. It gripped me from beginning to end. And I laughed all along the way and then bawled my eyes out at the end. I think this is an exquisite, for a feature debut, an exquisite film.
Well, I'm glad you were able to explain what you got out of it, Sarah, because I'm not actually able to do that. So I'll be coming over to Ben quite quickly. Every year on the podcast, there's normally one fuck-off film. Because it's going to happen, isn't it? It's going to happen. You've got different people. You've got people attacking different angles. You've got different tastes. This is that film. You know, you were right with your explanation. But I didn't find it funny whatsoever. I thought it was painful to watch. What, Ben, was this film actually trying to be funny? Because it completely passed me by, honestly.
I wasn't expecting the comedy. And just like I saw The House of Jack built recently, and I was surprised by the comedy in that. And again, I was surprised by the comedy in this as well. I wasn't expecting it. And I think the fact that I wasn't expecting it left me, I don't know, I'm not a for or against for I Am Not a Witch. I liked some bits of it. I found other bits a stretch. Although we just watched or talked about a big artificial film, there are moments in this where everything is very composed and beautiful and all that kind of stuff. And that's a big turnoff for me these days. In 2018, I want stuff a bit messier. Or something else. It felt a bit film four kind of pretty stuff to me, and ribbons and so on. But I'm not going to be against this film at all. There's a lot of good stuff to be had in this. Going into it, I was thinking of the. I'm going to make a literary reference again. Everyone, get ready for this. the Maupassant short story, The Piece of String, which is about a man in a village who sees a piece of string and he bends down and picks it up, and then from that one action, the whole town kind of turns against him, and they turn this act into, he must have been doing something else, and it just destroys his life completely. So I walked into I'm Not a Witch thinking about Maupassant, who's not funny, and then the funnies I wasn't expecting, but it's fine. I think a lot of people would really like this. It wasn't quite my cup of tea, but all power to Rungano. This is a really good debut, I'll say that for sure. I think it's promising. I don't got much else to say about this, but that's good, right?
Yeah. Oh, Sam, I'm sure you're delighted with that.
I am thrilled.
Yeah, there's plenty of time for revenge to happen, I'm sure. But I am stubborn on this particular film, and I think you had it, British writer. I mean, when we talk about stuff that we've enjoyed outside of the podcast, that's going to be a topic revisited, because it's a very pertinent one for me personally in 2018. For what I'm about to tell you later on, as well as this. I can't stand this film for its writing. It's just atrocious.
It's very written. It is very written.
Good grief. I just couldn't get on with it. Now, I appreciate, again, I say all year round what I think about British cinema and British films and all the rest of it. And then you have this. And there's nothing British about this movie, correct?
No.
Very little British about it. And yet, it feels British to me.
Yeah.
It's the bloody writing. And I wanted to give it a chance. Of course I did. The fact it was subtitled was even better, for the most part. And yes, the writing. I just couldn't get on with it. And whether you like comedy or not, it was there. But it just felt off to me. It all felt very contrived. And a bit too perfect, and a bit too, I wanted a bit more. Is dirt the right word? I don't know. Slum. I mean, just something. It was all too pretty, and yes, very clean, clinical, film four-ish. I agree with all of that. No, it just wasn't for me. And whether it's for lots of other people, I'm not the person to say to anybody whether this is for everybody, because it's just not my thing that much. I can kind of remove myself from a lot of the other films and kind of objectively say this one, it was just never going to work really. So in a way, you've either carried on listening to me for the last 5 years or you haven't. Either way, this particular review will not sway you either way with what I've always said. So no, and I think this squeaked into your top three, didn't it, Sarah?
Yes.
So there you go. There you go. But no, we've all got our crosses to bear on this list.
Oh, yeah.
I have no doubt. Let's move on. Let's move on to The Long Excuse, which is in my top three, by the way. Satchio, a struggling writer, come celebrity, loses his wife in a bus crash. He helps out the family of a friend who also loses his wife on that same bus crash, and basically finds himself in a new life, dealing with not only his own grief, but everybody else's too, whilst kind of helping his own writing career at the same time. Mm. Now, the word exquisite has been used from Sarah for the last film we just talked about. For me, this is an exquisite film. It's comfortably in my top three. It's a film all about how Japanese men deal with grief, and it's a topic very seldom shown in Japanese cinema for as long as I've been watching it. And what's especially interesting for me is how this film is based on a novel written by the director herself, Miwa Nishikawa. So you've got male grief from a female perspective and a writer's struggle from a writer's perspective. So that in itself is fascinating. But principally, for me, this is a film of perfection. I can't really find too much fault with it. Like, the pacing of it is fantastically well judged. The first half an hour is essentially all about Satchio, the writer, as a person. Like, how bitter, lonely he is, self-obsessed. which is where the celebrity thing comes in, and how utterly dislikable he is. Then the children get involved, and if you've been watching Asian cinema, but particularly Japanese cinema for the last decade, 20 years, whatever, or however long way back you want to go, as soon as children get involved with Japanese cinema, it just elevates it. And in this film, they are very young, and they are as sublime as always. And as someone who hasn't got kids, it's the second time ever, and I mean ever, I've watched a film, and it makes me want to have Japanese children. And I don't think it's going to happen, unfortunately, because they are just perfectly performed characters. But for the sake of the film, they're therapy for Sachio, because they are suffering from a lack of a mother figure, just like the men are suffering from their wife figures, if you will. And the way that the film carries everyone's kind of personal journeys through this thing to their natural conclusions, for me, was just awesome. And there was lots of imagery and symbolism used throughout. You've got the deleting of like the final text, last voice message that one of the people had kind of finally, you know, got over, if you will, and kind of accepted the fact she died. It was the symbolic deleting of the last voice message. Even more complicated than that, however, though, was the daughter who finally develops a voice, and like throughout the film she never actually says off you go when someone leaves the house, which is a Japanese custom, but by the end of the film, after all she's gone through, she finally wishes her brother off you go when he leaves the house. Like the son, he accepts his responsibilities more and more in his father's absence, kind of forgiving his own father for just being a truck driver, finally accepting his father's lack of intellect for what it is. While Sachio, it's the symbolic haircut. You know, he's never had his haircut cut by anybody else but his wife. And that changes. And at that moment, he's a changed person. He's not blaming his wife for his death. He's blaming himself. And he's kind of accepted his own inadequacies for what they are. And yet he doesn't necessarily hide from them either. He accepts for what he is. So, you know, there's lots going on in this film. There's a fair bit to talk about. But both you guys weren't on the episode when this film came out originally. It was actually the first one of the year, I believe, back in March. So, straight over to you guys, basically. Ben, The Long Excuse.
So, yeah, the voicemail message thing was a thing that really hit me, because that's something I think about when I get a lot of voicemails. Perhaps a dark place to go to, but am I ever going to hear from this person again? Mm-hmm. Does cross my mind. There were two things that really kind of hit me about this film. Hold on, wake up. One of them is questions of well-roundedness.
Yeah.
You don't see films every day where people get shown as well-rounded as they do in this film. People are allowed to be good and bad. They're allowed to have more than... They're not just cartoon characters. They're very, very well drawn out. That was one thing that really hit me. Another thing that I got from this was questions of altruism, or why people do things, or why people do good things.
Yeah.
Do they do good things to become good people, or do they do good things for something far more complicated than that? There's a lot going on in The Long Excuse. I also loved the bus journey as well.
Yes.
why? But I keep, sometimes when I watch these films, I think about the American remake, the awful, awful American remake in my head. And you know what the bus journey would have been like in the James Cameron version of The Long Excuse.
Absolutely.
But it's a gorgeous, poetic, quiet, contemplative film that asks some big questions and doesn't provide a lot of answers. It's a hell of a thing. It's not my top three, but I don't know why. I got a lot out of this. I think a lot of people who love Asian cinema should probably see this film. It would do them good.
It would. Sarah? Yeah.
I should have said this at the beginning, but I'm very positive on a lot of the films here. I think the only one I really don't like is The Wild Boys. So,
oh, dear me. Shots. Fired.
I'm gonna come across as I'm gonna be like, yeah, it's amazing, but this is like an exquisite bunch from an exquisite bunch of films that we've had all year. The same for The Long Excuse. I agree with everything you both just said. Masahiro Motoki's performance as Sachio is incredible and astounding, and I was gripped from the beginning, like the whole setup and premise. I kind of love that there's catharsis at the end. But yep. It's not necessarily a happy ending.
No, definitely not.
There is catharsis at the end. And I love that kind. I love dysfunction, and I love odd families. Watching this and Shoplifters recently, I don't think people can do dysfunctional families and oddball families quite as well as the Japanese can.
No, they can't.
And like you said, just make the Japanese children, I just kind of will adopt them all and have loads of Japanese children running around.
Join the queue. I'm number one in that queue.
Being amazing. And I just, I kind of, the dynamics and the premise and the acting and, it's just incredible. It's an incredible film.
I mean, the saddest thing about this film, apart from the actual film itself at times, is the fact that it's a 2016 film and it took 2 years to reach the UK. And it only reached the UK via the Japanese film touring program, which is a wonderful, blessed thing, and thank God for it. But, and the problem is that director and author, Nishikawa, she makes films every 4 years. So by my reckoning, it won't be until 2022 until we see her next one in the UK. Oh. That's sad. That's really sad, because she's only made, I think, one other film apart from this, or maybe two. But no, she gets it. And how interesting that she would make her own work into a film. That's what Hollywood doesn't do. They always adapt authors' work and have a film director do it. She is an author and a film director. So she's the only person that could have made this film work, because she wrote the bloody book. So that in itself is unique. I really can't think of too many examples where the author has actually directed the film as well. Not executive producer, directed the film. So
there's a couple of American ones.
I'm racking my brains.
No. Yeah,
I think The Perks of Being a Wallflower was directed and written by Stephen Chomsky. But that's it. That's all I can think of. Sorry.
Wowzers. Well, that's still more than I could. Me and Ben will be here. We're not trying to think of them. But no. Yeah. I mean, again,
Paul Auster directed a film.
But still, nothing compared to this, that is for sure.
But
symbolism and imagery again. You've got him biking up the hill with a girl on the back, and it's getting easier each time. So as the film's going on, he's getting more and more weight off his shoulders as he's trying to bike the girl up the hill. It's stuff like that, it's classic stuff. It instantly resonates with us as film viewers. It's just, a blessedly wonderful thing. This is in my top three, and so it should be. And this is an easy recommendation. It's the Japanese film of the year that I've seen. Now, I haven't seen Shoplifters, I admit, but if Shoplifters is similar to what I expect it to be, which is like Father Like Son, which is Koreeda's only other good film, literally, then even that, that will probably be as equal to this, not better. So I'm intrigued for sure. But The Long Excuse, splendid stuff. Blew my mind, Ben.
Not my pick, Sarah's pick, but coming back. Blew My Mind is the story of a 15-year-old who, is she starting a new school? I can't remember. have they moved to a new town?
Yes.
So they moved to a new town, starting a new school. It's that awkward, trying to make friends at school kind of experience. She falls in with a bunch of mean girls. They start playing these kind of weird games. And then she starts turning into a mermaid. It's a film we've seen 1,000 times before, but not this good. Blew My Mind is a really, really, really good example of this film where you take an adolescent girl's journey of change and discovery about themselves, and you drop a kind of metaphor in there. Like, I think previously we discussed Raw as one.
Yes, there's
Teeth would be a nice example of this weird subgenre as well. And Blew My Mind is just a very, very visceral, strong film, with a lot to say to everyone, I think, not just the teenage adolescent female experience. I think a lot of people get stuff out of this. Personally, I don't see the mermaid stuff as being real. I'm seeing that as a metaphor for other things. But that's fine. You can enjoy it either way. Yeah. Either it's a magical mermaid movie or it's all in the head. I really like this film. It really works for me. I don't know what more to say. The lead performance is fantastic. The main mean girl, she's fantastic too. It really surprised me when I started watching this film. I really wasn't expecting it to be this incredible. It really is. It's in my top three. It's a big fat number three for me. I really love Blew My Mind. Really something.
Sarah, are you proud?
Yes.
You should be.
Yes. And also, I just want to add that I choose to believe that she was a mermaid, because I said this last time, but it's every girl's dream to be a mermaid. We were all in the swimming pool. We were all
Alone
doing the Little Mermaid.
in
We
the
were all
ocean.
clipping our hair back. We were all that. We just wanted to be mermaids. And I mean, I'm going to put it out there, and I'm sorry, it's the only time this podcast ever mentioned this film. But I just watched Aquaman, and it made me all want to be a mermaid all over again. So that's it. Yes.
Well,
A friend of mine saw Aquaman, and I said, "Tell me one good thing about Aquaman." And he said, "Everyone's hair."
I thought you were going to mention that Julie Andrews was in it, but there you go. And the fact that she thought it was a better idea to be in that than Mary
Than Mary
Poppins too.
Poppins.
Because she
No,
did.
I think. Sorry.
Sorry, just because she didn't want to outshine, you know, everybody. Who Emily? What's the face? Who's in it? Oh, I've got memory. Who's in bloody Mary Poppins
Emily
too? Now,
Blunt.
is she in it? I don't know who's in it now.
Astonishing Emily Blunt.
Oh yeah. So yeah, but the fact that, but she, instead of her outshining her by being in the same film, Julie Andrews is outshining her by being in a different film. Because that brought people's
That's
attention. So well
some
done,
serious
Julie.
shade throwing going on there.
Well done, Julie. This is the surprise of the year for me, this film. Now, Swiss cinema is normally so fucking beige. You'd be forgiven for thinking it was like Stonewash, you know. And actually, Stonewash is more pleasurable to experience watching that dry than most Swedish films. Apart from the Swiss films, I should say. Not here. You know, on the surface, we've got a teen girl drama about bodily changes and friendships, blah, blah, blah. Tried and tested. We've all been there, or, you know, seen the films. But for the fact that the bodily change is into a mermaid is a masterstroke for me. And the potential with that is to somewhat romanticise it, right? I don't think it does, actually.
Not in
Um,
it
and,
at
and
all.
for the fact it's reviewed so inconsistently, some people love it and some people hate it, also tells me that it's not been romanticised and that a lot of people agree with that statement. It's somewhat grisly, it's gritty, without a single wink to camera, and come the end, it's beautiful. You know, I love the scenes of freedom. I love the scenes of release, and there's a few of those hints throughout the film as well that that's what's going to happen. I mean, it's fairly apparent what's going to happen, but you know what I mean. I've got a lot of time for the movie. It didn't quite make my top three, but literally it came fourth for me, and I felt disappointed for it because this is the kind of thing that I would want to champion personally. You know, it's Swiss, so it's well, and so therefore it should be beige and should be kind of so middle of the road. This is far from that. This is the most dynamic and exciting and interesting Swiss film I've ever seen, and normally they are just, as again, so plain. So you know, this was the closest of all of them to enter the top three without being in there. It's highly recommended, and I think, along with the director of Raw, whose name escapes me, Sarah, I'm sure you've hetch that in your brain who that person was, but another female director. This one is Lisa Brulman. I think her next film's definitely going to be worth checking out for sure.
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean,
Oh yeah.
she gets it.
Yeah,
And
she
again,
does. And I'm a big fan of, like, no surprise in my top three. I'm a big fan of transgressive cinema and transgressive characters and stuff. And this does that really well. These people are bad people and they're doing bad things. And it covers that ground really, really well without demonizing them and making them into, but I'm doing air bunnies, bad people per se.
no.
They're People are allowed to do
Bad
things
things,
which
yeah.
bad things without being bad people, and Blew My Mind does that really well. I could smell this film.
Absolutely. The whole redemption of the mean girl, where she turns out to actually be a really caring friend, is so, like, it's so well done of girl dynamics. Like, my only fault with this film, because it's my second favourite of the week, my old fault with this film is that, like, I just want to see a teen film where they're not doing so many drugs. Because, you know, I know it's like experimental, but I also was a nerdy kid and never did that. So it'd be nice to have some kind of film like this.
They know their stuff though. I was very impressed with Gianna's knowledge. She really
What
knows.
else is there to
She's
do
named
in Switzerland?
things really well, and they have like close-ups of the packaging. And yeah, it is. It's what Gianna says. It's a small thing, but you know, a lot of teen films are filled with people going like, "Here, take this pill, blow your mind." And Gianna's like, "No, these are benzodiazepines." I really like the kind of her literalness with everything. Her kind of her experience, and you know, she's like someone who's been driving for 5 years. She knows it,
Yes.
versus someone who's just started this week.
Lovely, lovely stuff. And what else is there to do in Switzerland apart from take drugs? Right.
Knock on the door, say hi.
Yeah, and evidently make half-decent movies all of a sudden. Right then, Custody, Sarah. Custody. We've got a French film on the list. It would have to be this one, though, to be
it's
fair.
It's the second Custody. French film. We forgot about The World, boys.
Oh, well, yeah. That is so shite as a movie that it doesn't have a passport.
Citizen of Nowhere.
But actually, you know what? No passport is better than a British one. Right then. So then, Sarah, Custody. A well-deserved entrant for Custody, as far as I'm concerned. What is Custody? What is it?
Custody is my favourite, I'm going to put it out there, of the week. Custody is a film by Xavier Legrand, and it revolves around a couple who are fighting for custody over their son. And the mother basically is turning around saying that he's been abusive, but no one quite believes her, so they have joint custody. And the father, Antoine, decides to use his son as a pawn to get back into his ex-wife's life. And this film... I tell you what, this film is such a palpable film. And I don't think it would be half the film it was if it didn't have Denis Menashe as the menacing Antoine. Because, my God, I can't look him in the eyes without feeling slightly terrified, because he has this really great way of capturing the horror and the manipulation and the anger and the rage just beneath the surface of his eyes. So even when he's trying to be, reasonable and nice and amicable, you can see it's always lurking at the tip of the surface, even to the point where his own family, like his own parents, throw him out at points. And it's just such an exquisite, but it's one of my favorite performances of the year, because it's so gut-wrenching. And when he appears, and the end sequences are so hard to watch, because they're so realistic in his way. I love this film. Absolutely.
Indeed. Well, this was on the episode that me and you were on, Sarah. Ben, this is first time you'll be speaking about it, so the floor is yours.
Well, yes, I don't have much to add. This is a hell of a film. Denis Menashe is... I don't know, is it his size? Is it just the shape of his body? He's just a very menacing, terrifying individual. And like Sarah says, it's even when he's trying to be nice, you can see what's going on underneath, just scraping through the skin. It's a difficult film to watch. If you know people who've gone through experiences like this, which I do, and you kind of find yourself taking sides without knowing the full story, but in the back of your head you're thinking, there's more to this than meets the eye, and so there's a lot of that going on, and then there's the final 15 minutes. So it's a very, very strong film. It's one of those kind of international cinema films for people who don't like international cinema as well. It's very accessible. You don't get bored at any point, even though there's subtitles. And it moves into something quite different. One thing I'll say the French do, what I call very well, is they do genre films without leaning into that genre too much. So they can do, like, Custody is essentially a kind of a thriller, but it doesn't lean into thriller territory in the same way that, like, La Monte Double does so much. It's easier than that. It's kind of like, it's more fluid in genre terms. It's just a very, very real, gripping film. It's like the Dardenne brothers, but ramped up a bit. That's what I'll say.
Well, what I'll say is that you guys have made me watch a lot of French films this year. And Custody is the best of them by far. But I'm getting a sense of deja vu here. Rewind to 12 months ago, and neither of you were present then, so you're not part of this. But have either of you seen Ghost Story?
Yes.
No.
Right. So Sarah will know exactly what I'm on about when I mention two words. Party, scene.
I'm having deja vu because you brought this up.
Right.
Last time, yeah.
Ghost Story, a quality product blighted by an abhorrently patronising and unnecessary party scene. Now, Ben, that won't mean anything to you. Sarah, that'll mean everything.
Just quietly tap away on my keyboard here. You guys talk amongst yourselves.
Right. Now, less of those adjectives here with Custody, but there's no doubt in my mind the party scene ruins the film for me. just at the moment when the tension was building so nicely, you have this fucking 10-minute-long party scene when awful band, and they are a dreadful band, perform Tina Turner's Proud Mary, which, in and on itself, is bad enough. But at least get some decent musicians doing it. And even having said that, even if you were to get, I don't know, The Who doing it, or Led Zeppelin, or the Rolling Stones, or somebody to perform Proud Mary in this movie, at the end of the day, it's still a 10-minute long song. Was the entire song at this party necessary to halt momentum? No. Because for me, it completely kills momentum. To the film's credit, it does recover somewhat with the remainder, as the tension kind of returns. You've got the chase, and you've got the execution, you get the police getting involved, and all the rest of it. It is exciting, but ultimately, you know, as a critic, I want the best for every film. And sometimes it is just one or two scenes here and there that can make a difference. And, you know, I obviously can allow things to happen in films that aren't exactly perfect. It doesn't necessarily ruin anything, but for this, and for Ghost Story, Sarah, it's the fucking party scene.
I think I will allow the party scene in this. And I know you don't like it, and I know it's problematic, and I get that it loses some of the momentum.
Why Proud Mary? It's a long song. Did Tina Turner do 2-minute songs, 3-minute songs? Any of those?
Just... At least it wasn't Steamy Windows. That would have been even...
But
are you guys talking about A Ghost Story?
Yes.
Okay, right, cool. That has Keisha in it? What the hell is Keisha?
Yeah, and in the party scene.
And it's a party scene where literally the director is standing in front of, well, not literally, because he's not.
Yeah, no, I can see he's neighbor's ghost, uncredited.
Figuratively speaking, he's telling the audience what will happen for the remainder of the film. That is actually correct, isn't it, Sarah? That is what happens. It's almost as if he got scared because he directed a fucking animation before that. Oh shit, who's my audience? I need to patronize them because I'm not sure. He basically said, for the rest of the movie, this is what you're going to get. I'm not sure you're going to understand it. That is what that party scene was all about, and it completely ruins the film, because up to that point you're cooking up all these wonderful ideas about, oh, is the ghost real? Well, of course it isn't, but it could be. Is it a physical thing? Is it mental? And all this wonderful stuff, and then it explodes into this world kind of time bending genre bending stuff, which we could have worked out for ourselves, thank you very much. Did not need to be signposted with a stoner and a drunk at a party talking
also
about...
at any party you go to, the stoner who's talking about philosophy is the worst person.
Exactly. It's hardly originally in film. So it was just such a bad step. It completely ruined it. Now, as I say, doesn't quite apply here, but the same thing is sort of there. This fucking party scene. Things were building up so amazingly perfectly. There's no need. You could have took it out. It wouldn't have made any difference, really. Just don't have it. Another party's part of the story where they have to go around to some party and some people are there, and then after that it kind of gets worse. Just show a couple of balloons. Show the balloons. Show the band for 12 seconds. Maybe 15. Not the entire Proud Mary. All 10 minutes of it, no. Just a really bad decision. And I expect so much more than that decision from the French. Because they're not Hollywood, so why did they do that? But they did. And so ultimately, that did cost it for me personally. But, as I say, out of all the French ones you made me watch this year... Good grief, it was the most palatable. By far.
What about 20 BPM? What happened to that?
That was my choice, and it was good. So you made me watch. And you know what I'm on about, Le Monde Double. You know. And don't forget, Hortense is Ho. Don't forget. So, Unicornio. Unicornio is a Brazilian movie set in the mountains. Maria is a 13-year-old girl who is awaiting the return of her father. Meanwhile, her mother starts to fawn, over the local goat breeder, fawn. Good. YouTube will be a great success for me. Testing the family relationship to the extreme. This is the first time a Brazilian film has made it onto the final shortlist, and it was only ever going to happen if a Brazilian film could get the artistry and the storytelling right, which this film does for me. I love it. It's top three for me, principally because this is a stunning film to look at. Like, I love the ratio of the film was shot in. The exteriors are pastoral, with an almost like fairy tale quality to them, which fits into the poisonous fruit. Does it not, boys and girls? Does it not? Whilst inside there's a warmth but there's also a claustrophobia as well, with a tangent, with a tinge of loneliness too, behind the whole thing. So many beautiful, beautiful shots in this movie. Narratively, there are plenty of questions asked. Sarah, it will be coming over to you to see whether you've got any of them answered on your second time of watching this film. Because I know it took me two goes, that is for sure. But as all the best films do, and some later on in this list will do, always open to interpretation. But on the whole, there is no doubt that this is a film about sexual frustration, lust, jealousy, envy. And for me, Sarah, a bloody good one.
Yeah, I think I like it a little bit more than I did. I mean, because don't get me wrong, I liked it the first time I watched it, because it is one of the most beautifully shot films on this list.
Absolutely.
And I liked it on the second watch again. But for some reason, I just couldn't connect with it still. There's something just not connecting me to the film. That being said, I enjoyed it a lot more this time around. I think maybe because I knew that I wasn't going to connect with it. If this makes any sense. I knew that I wasn't going to connect with it, and therefore my expectations were lowered slightly, and therefore I enjoyed it a lot more, especially for the visuals and its stories. I think maybe it could have been like the times, just over 2 hours, shaved off a little bit of that, and I probably would have enjoyed it more. But I love how it looks and it feels.
Ben, you're new to it. How did you get on with?
I am new to this. Let's all remember when Ben said about I'm Not a Witch that he didn't really have time for things that look good. And well, cut to now. I didn't love this. I have a thing against stuff that looks great and wants to be. I have my own ideas about what cinema can and can't be. And when stuff gets pretty, I just start getting angry. I didn't get super angry. I didn't hate this at all. I like a good fairy tale. I always think fairy tales are metaphors for other things.
Absolutely.
There's always something bubbling underneath. There isn't in this as well. I wished it wasn't unicorns. Unicorns are so boring.
It's an odd thing, because I've been racking my brains about why it was actually selected as a unicorn, why that was chosen. I mean, the character Maria, her father calls her a unicorn, and there's an attempt for that to be kind of justified in a way with her actions. Yeah. But I'm not getting it. I don't like that. I like the fact I don't get it. There's nothing wrong with that. But equally, it's like, really? Mm-hmm. Your whole premise of the film is the title, really. Mm-hmm. And the fact the first thing that you see is a unicorn. Mm-hmm. So you are ultimately, never mind the sexual frustration, lust, jealousy, envy, all the rest of it, and all sorts of, you know, questions are asked in this film. At the end of the day, you do have to have it tied round to the title of your film.
Yeah,
you know, you do.
Then you get stuff like Reservoir Dogs, where there's no dogs in that movie.
but obviously those dogs are metaphorical and they make sense.
Yeah.
But this one makes no sense. It just doesn't, unfortunately.
No. And I mean, and I can see a lot of people are going to like this film. I'm not sure about that.
It looks
pretty though.
It is pretty, but it's also difficult. I mean,
yeah.
There's not a lot of stuff that happens in this film.
No,
a lot of it you have to bring stuff to it, like, you know.
The experience of watching this brought me back to the experience of watching, was it Zama? That
Argentinian film, yeah.
Argentinian film.
You like that one, I think. Yeah.
Which I hated.
Oh, dear.
It brought me back
shots
to that a little bit.
Fires. No, actually, not Sarah. Were you big on Zama, or did you? I think you quite liked it. I think
Sarah loves Zama.
I love Zama.
Zama's
in some of my. It's like in my films of the year. I think it's like number 14. I can't.
Yeah,
quite
I wanted to punch everyone in the cinema. When I was watching Zama, I was like, "How dare you laugh at this stupid film?" I hated it so hard. I had a really, really negative response to Zama.
This coming from the guy who gave us the Wild Boys.
I know, right? Woo! Wild Boys! Alina's back!
I'm surrounded by rifle fire from both sides. It's like the other side of Winter Burdere, which we'll talk about in a minute, with a rifle video. Right. Nice fighting. But no, I agree with both. I haven't actually seen Zama, actually, but Unicornia is divisive. I would say it's one of the most divisive on this list. I mean, basically all
we've forgotten the Wild Boys. What are we?
Yes, that's up there. I would say that one and this one, and the one we will move on to. And that's what I like about this film actually being on this list, is that it does kind of relate to the next one, in the sense that you have to bring a lot to it And many different people would bring a lot of different things to this, but ultimately it's up to us to kind of get the most out of it. Without actually having the director's brain in our brain, which ain't going to happen, we're not going to know what this movie is really about. I mean, we can all offer certain things, and Unicornio kind of eases that by being such a beautiful film. But yeah, it's divisive, but I've not seen nothing like it, particularly from Brazil. I'm fine with Chilean, I'm fine with Argentinian. But yeah, the Brazilian stuff has always left me a bit cold, apart from this one. So for that reason alone, it deserves to be here, I think. But Winter Brothers, Benjamin. Winter Brothers, Winterbrodre, as they would call it.
Winterbrodre. This is Hlynur Pálmason's debut film. Yeah, that's right. It's his debut. It's his first film. Think about that. it's a film about two brothers who work in some kind of lime factory or whatever it is. Who cares?
A quarry will do.
What really matters is the fact that one of the brothers, Emil, is a bit of a rogue. He likes making homebrew liquor, selling it to his co-workers. He has a crush on a local girl called Anna. And hilarity ensues as Emil's life goes into a free fall. I really like this film. And when I was going into it, it's a film about two brothers in an environment where it's just a bunch of dudes. And I thought this is going to suck. I really wasn't expecting it like this. I love this film. It's really, really something special. It's my film of the week because it's just too wonderful. I don't know how to explain it. Watching it again for a second time was a really, really joyful experience, especially because I knew that Emil was never going to go to a really, really horrible place, which was kind of in the back of my mind the first time I watched this. I thought Emil's about to do something really off and I'm going to feel really bad, but he never does. Spoiler alert. He's a dick. He's juvenile, but he's free thinking. He says what he wants. With horrific consequences. The film gives you very little information. You have to do a lot of work. You have to bring a lot to this. I mean, even about two-thirds of the way through the movie, it just kind of stops for a series of medium shots of all the characters that you've seen so far, looking into the lens, kind of going, well, what do you think, huh?
What do you make of it? You, kid.
What do you think all this means, eh? I don't know. Is he dead? Maybe. Could have been. There's too much going on in this for me. It's an astonishingly well-made film. It's a film that's got a serious intention behind the way it's made. It knows exactly what it wants to do. It doesn't cover scenes in the kind of standard way. Especially when people are making their first movie, they tend to overcompensate by playing everything safe all the time. This film doesn't play anything safe at any stage. It's really good. It's really something. It's very difficult. A lot of people are going to really hate this. Your racist uncle is going to, at the end of it, yell, what's all that about? It's not a film for people who hate international cinema in any way whatsoever.
No.
I think maybe perhaps if you like Gummo and Carl Theodore Dreyer films, then this is the one for you, perhaps, because it's got this kind of religious insight into a life of real scuzziness. And bearing in mind that I keep saying I love transgressive films and transgressive people, boom, this does that really well. Some wonderful interiors. Emil and his brother living space is that took me back to going to see some poor friends. Again, it's one of those films you can smell. It's fantastic. The end of the film makes me so happy, where he's doing tricks for Anna. I love that sequence.
The water changing color and stuff. Yeah.
The liquid changing color is just wonderful. It gives you magic. It's drier. It's the word. So in conclusion, I am for Winter Brothers. Yeah,
indeed so. And whose choice was that? Yeah, of course, mine.
Yeah, you're not getting points for this.
I am, though. I am.
You're going to please a badge.
And wait till what happens at the end. Right, knowing I was going to watch this one again, and actually that's the point for all of these, opinions can change and things we can pick up and stuff like that. I actually had serious concerns watching this movie again. Firstly, because I loved it so much the first time around, because of the 90s, the Dreyer stuff, but as I said last time, the 90s Zentropa style of framing and shooting and filming, the lens filter, the camera style and all the rest of it. Knowing, and of course it wouldn't have the same effect the second time round because I knew it was there, I'd have to start looking for other things. But that was for the best. because much to my own surprise, it actually manages to hold its own against other films in this list that are actually far more concerned with storytelling than this movie is. And it actually, in some instances, it actually surpasses them for the story in this movie. Like, you know, Life on the Quarry will be a place to start. As you said, you've got the brotherhood, you've got the bond with your workers, i.e. Winter Brothers. And really then it's like how a singular moment can, like, or a decision or a bad decision can destroy that bond forever. Another great Danish film, The Hunt, had that, of course. And any film that brings about the memories of another great film is a great film. But, you know, that would be enough, really. That would be enough for a quality film by itself. Then you've got some other things. You've got the Dre stuff you've mentioned. For me, this is also a critique of Danish movies and cinema. You've got Emil's brother who says to Emil, there's no need to be so dark and aggressive, which is exactly how you describe Danish detective movies, Danish noir, Scandinavian noir, of course. We've all seen 100 times now. It's littered with dark people, littered with aggressive characters. So it was obviously a conscious choice for them to set everything here, in a snowy white environment with a snowy white backdrop of the quarry as well. And yet, because director Parmesan constantly plays with his audience in this film all the time, that which is why it is the most divisive film on this list, in my opinion, because some people just don't get on with that at all. And that's fair enough in to a point. You know, he's playing with us. So there are some dark, lots of dark in this film, lots of aggressive characters as well. In fact, more so than not. So that was fascinating. But for me as well, this could be a film about fallen Danish soldiers in conflict throughout the years. You know, you've got the mountains of stone and dusty rock that look an awful lot like Basra to me. Or it could be about the First World War. You've got the rifle videos, which are an obvious thing, but then you've got a pile of unmanned helmets in a pile on the ground. You know, or you've even got the use of homebrew, and you know, spirits were banned in 1917 in Denmark. So much like moonshine in the States, there had to be creative ways to get things of booze. That's in the film.
There's an interesting history of booze in Iceland as well, which is where Hlynur Parmason's from.
Yes, of course. And he's
was illegal until like 2010 or something.
Yeah,
ridiculous.
So illegal. So I mean, no, any of that, all of that, could be absolute bollocks. But that's the point. With great pieces of art, it's subject to conversation and to interpretation. And this film, more than any other on this list, does that. Now, Sarah, you were due to speak about this when we did it originally, but you unfortunately had a conflict of diary busyness. So now's your chance to say what exactly you think of Winter Brothers.
I think it took me a long time to mine exactly what you guys were saying about this film. But if you look at my top favorite films of all time, they are all explorations of masculinity.
Is a masculine film.
This is a juvenile masculine film. But yeah.
This is a pork scratching of a film.
Yes, this is like the men, drunken men, being men, and isolated men, and loveless men. And I enjoy it. I love it. I think it's a great film. I think it struggles in some aspects. I think it doesn't quite, like, you know what he's trying to say, but it doesn't come across well, the director. But the like you said, the visuals, that kind of visualness, and like, you know, we're going to talk about men and loneliness, and they're sending them in the snow and the ice and the rock and the quarries and the rifles. And for some reason I'm like, yeah, I love it. I love me some men talking about masculinity. And
you get a naked fight as well.
Fights, always good for the females, of course.
Yeah, I mean, you know, gotta love a bit of titillation. Gotta get them in. Yeah. This is why I watched Aquaman on the weekend.
Great hair.
I disagree slightly. I'm not entirely sure, actually, what Parmesan is trying to say. It could be anything that you said. It could be anything that Ben said. It could be anything that I said. It could be none of those things.
I think it's none of those things. I think he's doing something else. I think he would absolutely hate to explain what he's doing. There's no need.
One of those, guarantee.
No, I made the film. There you go. All the answers are there. Go watch it.
But that's the best, isn't it? Surely. I mean, why?
And
why
the fact that the rifle guy's British, I think, is important as well. Everything is beguilingly simple but deeply layered mystical film that you're not going to see every day.
True not. And I mean, speaking about the performers as well, I mean, you've got Lars Mikkelsen in there, who is Lars Mikkelsen, am I right?
Yeah. I do get the feeling that they covered all of his scenes in 2 days.
What a 2 days.
Yeah.
He's just absolutely terrific. And then, of course, Elliot Crossett Hoover, who made it onto the list last year with E Blodette. He was in that. And he's in this. So he's getting himself in some quality productions, and good on him, because he's got a face for it, hasn't he? He's just got this face that you want to punch.
You also get, I never noticed before, but the guy he gets the gun from in the beginning, that's Anush Hoover?
Yes.
Is that his father or something?
Potentially. I mean, it surely makes sense, doesn't it?
Ah. I'm going to quietly look this up while you guys talk.
That Winter Brothers, quality stuff. And it's also private. It's a private film. And I'm sort of glad that it seems to be a bit of a, you either love it or you don't thing. Yeah. I'm perfectly content with that, because it's just too special to be commercial. And I know... that's a really bad thing to say when you want everyone to make money and be rich, but the fact that this didn't get chosen by Denmark or Iceland, in a way that kind of satisfies me, because I want it to be a special little timepiece, which I think this film is. It's going back to the old days. It's also showing how Danish films should be made now, from an Icelander who lives in Copenhagen, which is interesting. So good on Winter Brothers.
Can't wait for its sequels, the Spring Brothers, the Summer Brothers, and the Autumn Brothers.
Oh, Knausgaard style,
So obviously, in the summer, when they're surrounded by lots of green and trees, that's going to be a tribute to Danish soldiers who fought in the Vietnamese War. not that I think we're any of them there, but there you go. That's already my theory out the window. But yes, nice. We're going to end on some animation. Have a nice day, Sarah. This I think this was on your first episode of the year, I believe, or if not the first one of the early ones.
Yes.
What is this?
Have a Nice Day is a Chinese animation dark comedy film by Liu Jian, and it revolves around Zhao Zhang, who is a driver for a gang, who decides to steal a buttload of money for his girlfriend to save her failed plastic surgery. And as I said before, I love films that revolve around masculinity and men, but the things that trump that are films about bumbling criminals. And that's basically what Have a Nice Day is. It's 75 minutes of seedy people doing stupid things and trying to catch each other for it. It's a very dark comedy with this crude animation style that reminded me of 90s cartoons. And has this, it's just wonderful kind of flow of energy of, and just kind of the worst people you can think of trying to get this money and trying to all like vie for it. And I think it's great. I think it's wonderful. I think like the crime boss has this really, really put on side right hand man who is my favorite character of the whole thing. And I think it's great. It's a great little rambunctious little comedy animation.
Well, I mean, it starts well. I mean, it sets the scene exactly how I'd like to see it. You've got a Tolstoy quote, which is always good, because it just makes you realise how lucky you are to see this movie. then you see the urban wasteland of China. You've got lots of dreariness and washed out colour and stuff. Great. I'm now in for a wonderfully bleak animated film, and I'm ready for the engaging story to carry me on for the next hour and a quarter. It didn't happen. I was bitterly disappointed, Ben. Disappointed. I don't think, and I apologise if I'm wrong on this, but I don't think it's an exaggeration to say nothing actually happened in this movie.
No, would you? I mean, that can be a positive.
It can be a good thing, but
Seinfeld of
not,
animation.
Not when you're giving me Tolstoy at the beginning. I want stuff to happen then.
Yeah. I mean, my big problem. This is the weakest film for me. I mean, number one, it's an animation film, and I don't respond very well to
animation. Oh, dear. Shots fired at former presenter Alex Sargent.
Yeah, they are not my cup of tea. Secondly, when it started, I thought, ooh, this looks like Jeff Darrow. I don't know if anyone knows the comic book artist Jeff Darrow, but he used to be big back in the 90s. Worked with Frank Miller and stuff, and this looks like his stuff. And I was like, oh yeah, cool, I'm in for a ride. But the style of animation really left me cold, in the same way that like Family Guy or something just leaves me really cold. I can see that people would like this. I'm not going to be down on it. I'm not going to call it the worst film ever made. But it's a big two thumbs down from me. But yeah, a lot of people would like it. Yeah. That's my review.
I think another problem for me was it's just that Coco blew my mind earlier on this year, which, you know, I know it was Pixar and all the rest of it, and this is the foreign language film podcast and stuff, but Coco was brilliant. You know, it was...
See, I can't watch Pixar anymore. I just can't do it. I can't go there.
I appreciate that and all the rest of it, but... and I'm dubious about Toy Story 4, but Coco, when they do something original... They are still the best in the world for me.
The Book of Life.
They are absolutely the best. They get the emotional side. They just get it right. And nobody else quite manages to do that, particularly from America. And this couldn't come close to matching Coco in any way. That said, it's got its own market to hit. You know, the foreign language animation scene is huge. You've got Belgium, you've got Israel, you've got all sorts of things happening. Well, animation expert, former presenter Alex Sargent loved it, so I think that is your review, basically. Sarah's fine with it, Alex loved it, and check that out if you like. But folks, it's results time. Those are all 9 films. And just to a quick point for long-term listeners, and funny enough for me to bring it on the last ever episode, but we changed the voting system this year. Thanks to too many fuck-ups from others who are no longer with us, we've actually done a democracy kind of thing here. So we've all awarded points on a scale of 1, 3 and 5 for our top threes, and we've all hinted at what our top threes would be, but not necessarily the right order of those. But I can reveal that in third place this year was Blew My Mind. Well deserved, but not quite there, obviously. Joint second place, we've got The Long Excuse and Custody. So that's your joint second films. And the film, the final ever film of the year for the Outside Centre Film Podcast, Winter Brothers.
Yes.
It kind of had to be, really, didn't it?
It does. It doesn't have a distribution deal yet for the UK, which is heartbreaking.
But the fact that we're talking about it, we recommended it months ago, people should check it out. It's won the prestigious Outside Centre Film Podcast film of the year. And I think we all liked it, that's fair to say. It was my number 3. It was your number 1, Ben. You know, and Sarah was quite happy with it as well. I mean, would it be in your top 5, Sarah? Or...
Yeah. I enjoyed all the films by the Wild Boys.
Winter Brothers is film of the year. But again, I am a little bit gutted that it isn't Blew My Mind, actually, because that was a more surprise for me. Danish cinema's always been a thing for me. Icelandic cinema's been a thing for me for a long time as well. So, yes, I didn't expect it to come about this way. I didn't expect it to be filmed this way. But ultimately, I always go into every Danish film thinking for their absolute best, and it normally delivers. Swiss cinema, no. No chance. So for it to deliver what it did, that blew my mind, is an equivalent of Winter Brothers for Switzerland. Believe me. Which isn't to say that ordinary films, you know, aren't just as equally as pertinent and as important these days. But equally, you don't come across films like Winter Brothers that much. You really don't. And will it ever get a distribution deal? I mean, you'd want it to. But, what would 3 days that occurs on cinema actually do that much good for it? I mean...
Not really.
I don't know.
I don't think it's a curse an audience crowd movie, really.
It's a tough one to play. It's a tough one to place because it's very artistic. But it's very, very specific. I mean, you really, really want to like it. And it's made, of course, it's made easy with our knowledge and our backgrounds, particularly yourself and Ben and myself with Denmark and things. But, you know, it's hard to see that pitch, that meeting happen with people. I mean, Sarah, you're highly in, obviously. You are Mrs. Picture House Central. would that be a thing that would happen? You know, would you say, I've seen Winter Brothers, we should get it here for a week or not? I mean, it's difficult.
I think it'd be one that, because we have a strand called Discover Tuesdays, which is a one shot, one screening Tuesday, like very cheap price. God, I sound like a salesman. A very cheap price. You can go and watch this random foreign feature, which is where I watch stuff like Zama and Have a Nice Day. We just kind of randomly show them on a Tuesday. And I think there is an audience out there who would go and watch a random Danish film or whatever. And maybe it would register further. Like, for example, Cold War for us sold out. We put it on Discover Tuesdays, it sold out. So we did it a longer run. And I think people need... I think if people would... I think my belief in foreign cinema is, in mainstream cinemas, even mainstream indies like Curzon and Picture House, is that there is an audience there, but people don't look after that audience well enough.
No, they don't. That is exactly right.
And I think that's the only way. You've got to keep it consistent and constant. And you've got to make sure it's there. Like, even if it's 1, 2, 3 random screenings in a week, just put it out there. You know, it's not going to cost you too much to just have a small people snowballing and trying to find these films.
Sarah, Hilna Parmesan's entire future is in your hands. And that's not an that is not an exaggeration. It's up to people like you and Lord Curzon to get this movie in people's accessibility radar, really. So good luck with that. Right. Final thing before we go then, folks. Final thing, because we all watch stuff outside of this dear podcast, and we'll continue to do so forever. But what's caught your eye, Sarah? That something that we haven't talked about on the podcast, we haven't reviewed, something that maybe might have made your personal three if we had reviewed it, maybe was just good for a different reason, just for unique, or even for being so unbelievably bad you haven't forgotten it. What's the one film this year that stands out apart from these nine?
I think for me, there's a film I think is very underseen, even though Barack Obama put on his list of best films of the year.
He also put Shoplifters there, actually, didn't he, as well?
Shoplifters. Yeah, he had a good list.
He should have been the presenter on here with the amount of foreign language cinema that was on there.
He put on there. He was kind of, yeah, he knew what film's about. I was quite surprised. It's a film called Blindspotting, which is a very like hour and a half film by David Diggs and Rafael Casal, and it's an American indie film that looks at the racial tension of America, which is obviously what a lot of American indie films are producing at the moment, but does this for this parolee who's got 3 days left on his parole, and he's trying to survive those 3 days, but also in those 3 days hooks up with his friend who winds up getting into more trouble, and also witnesses a police shooting and struggles on whether he should come forward or not as a witness. And it's one of those films that knows how to switch tone really well and bounces through it very rhythmically. It's wonderfully shot. It's inventively shot, and has some really outstanding performances that I think a lot of people are missing at the moment. And I think it'll probably come out in home release in February, and it's just definitely worth a watch. I think it's one of the fresher films I've seen this year, especially from American indie films. Had every beat right and switched tones. It just knew how to go from shock to comedy to feeling to emotions to sadness, and did it in an inventive way.
Sounds interesting to me. Ben, what have you got? In fact, I know what you've got, because you've been itching to get this on for about 4 months. And unfortunately, much like Winter Brothers struggling to get a cinematic release over here, Climax hasn't been seen since you've seen it. And that was a long time ago, right?
It was back in September. It had about a week of release. So yeah, Gaspar Noé's latest film, Climax, which is, I don't have words to explain how much I enjoyed watching this film. It's his most fun film by far. It's his most accessible film by far as well. People are still going to walk out because it's a hell of a trip. I absolutely loved it. Had a lot of fun. One of my girlfriend's colleagues went to see it on the same night, came back and said, well, that was the most unpleasant claustrophobic experience I've ever had.
Oh God, that sounds like fun. I love it. You've got me there already at that.
I cannot imagine why he found it, why he had that kind of response. It's just such a joyful, fun film. People who know me in real life will know that over the last few years, I've got an increasing interest in kind of dance and movement based stuff as a kind of director. I'm kind of trying to find non-narrative ways to talk about the human condition. And one of these has been dance and movement. So for Gaspar Noé to make a film about dance, that was wonderful by itself. Then you got Sophia Bataille as the star, who I've been following since she was the Nike dancer. She's an Algerian dancer she's got a successful film career going, but she's always misused. She's never used as a dancer, which is her principal talent. So for her to be used in that way, that was fantastic. And then the entire film plays out like a dance piece. If you're listening to this and you're a fan of like Pina Bausch's the spring one, Rite of Spring, Sacred Spring. If you're a fan of that kind of stuff, you're going to love Climax, because it's got this, it's about dance, and it uses dance. The camera is a dancer in the performance. It's a wonderful, wonderful film. It's just, I don't have words. I went to see it at cinema twice. I wish I'd seen it three times, because it's gone now. It doesn't come out on DVD until February, released by Arrow.
Well, February's a busy month next year.
it was just such a joyful thing.
So to all of you who have been with us for a long time, thank you very much. And the reason this is not a sad affair whatsoever, A, because it doesn't deserve to be, and B, because we're going to be carrying on anyway. So I will literally be seeing you all very soon, hopefully, quarter one, 2019. If you want to hit up Ben Woodywis to see what he's making next, then do that. He's got a film reel on his Twitter page he's got a link to, and other things at Ben Woodywis. Just type him in, you'll find him somewhere or another. Yes. And then, of course, if you want to go watch a decent movie in London, you're spoilt for choice, but why not the Picture House Central? Because they care about foreign language cinema on a Tuesday, and that's exactly one day more than most other cinemas give a shit about world cinema in a whole year. So, check out Sarah Cook's Picture House Central Cinema all over London as well. But that's it, folks. Happy New Year to all of you. And again, I will literally be seeing you very, very soon. 99 and out.